there's a free trade common market being built with Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay. Chile and Mexico have a free trade agreement. Central America is moving in that direction. And when you integrate your economies and there's trade and growth on both sides and the barriers to commerce and investment and business are broken down, it's much harder to go to war with your neighbor.
We'll look at the future of Latin America on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. The North American Free Trade Agreement forges a new relationship between the United States and Mexico, and in doing so, it pulls the U.S. even closer to the other countries of Latin America. Here to talk about the future of international relations in the Western Hemisphere is former Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, Bernard Aronson. Aronson has said that the most hopeful outline for the so-called New World Order may be emerging right here.
In Latin America and throughout the Western Hemisphere, the idea of democracy and the practice of democracy has taken root in a profound way. And more than that, there is a commitment on behalf of the nations of this hemisphere that was embodied in a resolution adopted unanimously by the OAS in Santiago in 1991, that the countries of this hemisphere collectively will defend democracy when it's at risk. That is an enormous historic change in Latin America, where the doctrine of non-intervention essentially foreclosed that kind of collective action. And it creates a community of democracies that are committed to working together to defend democracy. Secondly, if you look in, throughout this hemisphere at the large threats to the peace that prevail in other parts of the world, such as proliferation of nuclear weapons or missile technology, in this hemisphere they're being resolved peacefully and cooperatively. Brazil and Argentina have both signed agreements to put their nuclear programs under international safeguards and to bring into force the Treaty of Tlatelolco, which is the non-proliferation treaty in Latin America. Argentina voluntarily dismantled and destroyed a program that had been carried out secretly by the previous government to develop ballistic missile technology. Brazil, Argentina, and Chile signed the Mendoza Declaration forswearing chemical or biological weapons. The regional conflicts that still rage in Angola or Afghanistan and even to some extent in Cambodia have been resolved in this hemisphere in Salvador and Nicaragua through international mediation. So I think we have an opportunity, if we continue these trends, to build a genuine community of democracies and one linked by free trade from Alaska to Argentina. And clearly, NAFTA is the beginning of that, but NAFTA ought to be just the start. We need to move quickly to open the door to NAFTA to other democracies that adopt market reforms.
All right, there are some great issues in there that I want to explore a little farther. There was a piece in Foreign Affairs not too long ago that Abe Lowenthal wrote, and he asked a question in there. He said, quote, "Has Latin America finally turned the corner toward economic growth, democratic government, hemispheric community?" It sounds like you think Latin America
has
turned the corner.
Well, I don't think we should be declaring victory. In fact, the history of this region is just when the trends are positive and there's hope, the United States turns away and neglects the region and conditions change and things go bad again. And I think there are some danger spots on the horizon, and there's some deep systemic problems in all of the countries of the region that you can't ignore. There's still enormous gaps between a very wealthy elite and the great mass of people. There are gaps in some very important countries between the population of Spanish origin and indigenous people. There are still real gaps between military institutions and civilian governments. And there are enormous weaknesses in institutions, both non-governmental institutions and in the capacity of government to deliver basic services, clean water or clean sheets and food in a hospital. So I don't think we should declare victory. And frankly, even on the economic front, Latin America is still vulnerable to world economic trends. And I think really the issue is not whether we should break out champagne, but how do we sustain the positive movement and meet new challenges that are going to emerge.
I think in Lowenthal's piece, the quote I wrote down from his own personal response to that was that euphoria about Latin America is as unjustified now as indiscriminate bearishness was 5 years ago.
I think indiscriminate bearishness was more unjustified. But I don't think euphoria is the right response now either.
I want to go back to one of the things you mentioned in your initial answer, the idea that disputes in this hemisphere are being settled in a peaceful manner more and more. What can we learn from that maybe we can apply elsewhere in the world?
Well, I think several things. First of all, economic integration helps bring peace between neighbors. Chile and Argentina almost went to war in 1978. El Salvador and Honduras did go to war in the same period. Peru and Ecuador fought a bloody war 50 years ago, and there have been a history of cross-border conflicts that have claimed thousands of lives in Latin America but don't receive too much attention in this country. But over the last 5 years, you've seen an enormous process of breaking down trade barriers between the countries of the region. We've focused in the media on free trade between the United States and Latin America, but there's now essentially free trade between Colombia and Venezuela. In the Andean Pact, they've essentially reduced internal tariff barriers. There's a free trade common market being built with Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay. Chile and Mexico have a free trade agreement. Central America is moving in that direction. And when you integrate your economies and there's trade and growth on both sides and the barriers to commerce and investment and business are broken down, it's much harder to go to war with your neighbor. And so that's one lesson, I think, that economic integration helps produce political integration. But secondly, I think we've learned some lessons about how the international community can help resolve regional conflicts and the importance of outside actors. In the case of Salvador or Nicaragua, conditions had to be ripe for a peace process to begin, and it would probably not have worked in the same way 5 years ago, but local conditions alone weren't enough to produce peace. None of the parties trusted each other enough to make peace. All of the parties had to be pushed at critical times in the process, and there, outside countries, particularly in the case of El Salvador, Mexico, the United States, Colombia, Venezuela, and Spain, which were brought in by the Secretary General of the UN, played a crucial role, often behind the scenes in pressuring or reassuring both the government and the FMLN. And the United Nations played a critical role as an umbrella under which the peace talks could go forward as an international institution that had the prestige to press both sides and which neither side wanted to see blame them for failure. And the UN provided enormous resources and people in El Salvador to restructure the police, to guarantee the peace as peacekeepers, to help disarm the FMLN, to help guarantee human rights. And really new ground was broken in peacekeeping and peacemaking. The FMLN and the government didn't just sign a peace treaty and agree to stop shooting at each other. They agreed on fundamental reforms of that society. And the UN was the institution that helped midwife those reforms. So I think there's a lot to learn from those models. And if you look at other parts of the world, perhaps some of those elements weren't there, and that's why those regional conflicts continue to rage on.
And so you see that UN OAS activity continuing, the peaceful resolution of disputes?
Well, that all depends on the actions of the nations of those institutions. The UN, the OAS cannot act alone. They're totally dependent on the member states. But I think there's some good models for success that we shouldn't forget at a time when the UN is being blamed for failures elsewhere. But there are also, I think, lessons to be learned. I think the UN was able to respond to opportunities that existed on the ground. When it tries to go beyond the opportunities that exist on the ground, as perhaps it tried to do in Somalia, then it can also wind up breeding a reaction, and I think that happened there.
How much or to what extent do you think the positive developments that we've seen in Latin America, how much are those due to some kind of evolution internally in those countries, and how much is due to perhaps explicit or implicit coercion from the U.S. playing the 900-pound gorilla in the hemisphere?
Well, first of all, I think it's a big mistake to believe that the way the U.S. influences Latin America is through coercion. I think that's not the case. But I do think that the trends and developments in Latin America have been caused by both internal changes and internal forces and U.S. leadership, and that the two are synergistic and mutually reinforcing. And I'll give you some examples. Why did Latin America embrace a free market model and dismantle the statist, highly protected import substitution model that had governed the... It did so in part because the debt crisis forced these governments to confront the systemic problems of their economies. The commercial banks were not going to lend more billions of dollars to governments that couldn't pay the $400 billion that they had borrowed in the 80s. And so they were forced to adopt measures that were in their own interest by internal problems and crises. On the other hand, the United States led an effort to provide a debt reduction package through the Brady Plan, which explicitly tied debt reduction, which these governments and these political leaders needed desperately, with economic reform. So we created an incentive and a reward. Those governments that carried out reform were able to gain a debt reduction package that reduced their debt service by usually about a third, which was, you know, billions of dollars a year in the case of a country like Mexico or Argentina. And they were able to show their population that they were gaining something for their difficult sacrifices. So it was a win-win situation. So I think it's more often the case that the United States will influence behavior in the region by providing positive incentives and rewards for leadership, as well as standing up to and trying to criticize behavior that we disagree with. I think you need to do both. I think our moral voice is important. I think it was important that we denounce the autogolpe, the self-coup in Peru, the day after it happened. I think it was very important that we and others spoke out strongly and unequivocally against a similar action in Guatemala. But it's a mistake to think that the United States can only influence other governments, particularly in this region, in a negative way. I think we have to also have a set of incentives.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with former Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, Bernard Aronson. He now serves as an international advisor to Goldman Sachs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
Can you talk about those coups you just mentioned just a little bit? What role did the U.S. play briefly in those?
The case of Peru, President Fujimori actually carried out that action on April 5th, and I had arrived in Lima that day to have a series of meetings with the government. That was not the best timing from my point of view, but it also gave me an opportunity to react immediately on the ground. So first of all, I canceled my meeting with President Fujimori, and I made it clear that I wouldn't meet with him. I then went to see the human rights coordinator in a very visible way and brought the television cameras with me in order to try to show support and to offer some protection. The U.S. acted immediately to suspend all assistance to the Fujimori government and to call for an OAS meeting to deal with Peru under the Santiago Declaration. And we talked to other governments that had influence with Peru, particularly Japan, which was leading with the United States an effort to help Peru overcome its debts to the international financial institution. And we coordinated our efforts and our diplomacy. And I think that, along with a strong OAS reaction, helped convince the Peruvian government to schedule new elections and also to undo some of the restrictions on political freedoms that they had put in place. In the case of Guatemala, there was a similar reaction, and here all of Latin America joined together in the United States in making it clear we would not recognize the new government as legitimate. We sent a high-level OAS delegation to talk to both the Serrano government and the military and make it clear this had to be undone. And when there was an effort to manipulate our support and make it appear that we supported a vice president taking power, we made it clear that we did not. And in a matter of days, that combined with a strong Guatemalan internal reaction, and I wouldn't want to minimize the role that that played, but those two together, a strong and united hemispheric reaction and a strong united internal reaction, reversed the coup. And within a matter of a week or less, the former human rights ombudsman, René de León Carpio, was elected president, and those who tried to carry out the coup were in exile.
You talk about hemispheric, sort of that idea of hemispheric community, apart even from economic integration, the idea that we exist as a community of nations that share something in common. Another example I've heard you use is the one about Venezuela's role during the Persian Gulf War.
Well, I think it's a good example of why Latin America is important to the United States. We had very good and friendly relations with Venezuela, and we strongly came to the defense of the democratic government there when there was a coup. But at the time of the Gulf War, when Iraq's oil supply and then Kuwait's oil supply was taken off the market, the United States and the entire industrialized West faced an enormous increase in oil prices, which could have triggered another bout of inflation such as we saw in the 70s, which had a devastating effect on our economy for many years. President Bush talked to President Carlos Andres Perez and asked for help. Venezuela announced the next day that it was increasing its oil production by 2.3 million barrels a day, which made an enormous difference in stabilizing prices and counteracting the effect of the Gulf War. And I think we shouldn't forget that friendship works both ways in Latin America.
On the economic integration side, do you foresee a day sometime in the future where there will be a free trade zone encompassing all the nations of...
Yes, I think that day will come. I don't think it'll be entirely done in this century, but I think it's an idea whose time has come and the reality is coming. And I think it's important that the United States move quickly to open the door. Chile is clearly... been designated both by the previous administration and the Clinton administration as the next candidate, and they're ready economically and politically to join NAFTA. But we ought to set out a series of criteria that spell out the rules of the road for the rest of the hemisphere, both on democracy and human rights, on free markets and access of U.S. Investment and business to their markets, on environmental grounds, and make it clear that those governments that meet those criteria the soonest will be the ones who have a chance to join the North American Free Trade Agreement, because that provides the kind of incentives that I talked about and gives political leaders a goal and a reward to continue down the path of democratization and reform. And rather than leaving that vague and as if it's an arbitrary process, I think we ought to spell out clear criteria and encourage almost a competition for countries in the region to who can meet those criteria the fastest.
As the Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, you took part in historic diplomacy in Latin America that signaled the genuine change in U.S.-Soviet relations. Could you tell us what the lasting, as you look back on it, what's been the lasting significance of that, not only for our relationship with Latin America, but also for the former Soviet Union?
Well, we came in at a time when then-President Gorbachev had proclaimed his new thinking in foreign policy, and he said to the United States and to the international community that the Soviet Union was going to pursue an entirely new course in foreign policy, no longer supporting subversion and violent revolution, willing to cooperate in the settlement of regional disputes, cooperate in democratization, cooperate in other areas as well. And I felt that that offered an enormous opportunity for us to test new thinking and test the Soviets in Central America, because they had a strong and long-standing political military relationship with the Sandinistas, and yet the United States was embracing a policy that should have been and was acceptable to the Soviets, which was full support for the Escapulas Agreement authored by President Arias, support for internationally supervised election, and end to the armed conflict. And my first trip as Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs was actually to Moscow, which is not the usual first stop for an Assistant Secretary who's responsible for Latin America and the Caribbean. And I began talks with my counterpart and a Deputy Foreign Minister on this basis, and I was enormously and pleasantly surprised by how positive the response was. And from that time on, the United States and the Soviet Union worked together very closely to support the elections in Nicaragua, to guarantee that the results were respected. And then we went on to cooperate both in the UN and outside the UN in supporting the peace process in El Salvador. And that actually was one of the first arenas where Soviet and American cooperation fundamentally changed in the Cold War and post-Cold War period. And I think at a time when other areas were not moving as well in the U.S.-Soviet relationship, it in fact was a bridge to the future. It gave both sides confidence and trust that in fact that we could look at long-standing problems that had divided us for a decade and find common ground. So I think it both was good for Central America, and it sent out a very liberating signal to both the left and the right that there wasn't an East-West conflict that they could play off anymore. But it also, I think, strengthened the Soviet and American cooperation and trust at a crucial period.
Woven throughout your answers, there have been some things about what the U.S. should be doing now. How would you rate the Clinton administration on their Latin American policies, and what suggestions would you give them?
Well, I think the most important decision they faced in the first year was to support the North American Free Trade Agreement. I think if we had failed to ratify NAFTA, it would have been a devastating and destructive signal to Latin America. And fortunately, that was passed by a healthy majority, and I give the administration credit for waging a good and tough and a successful fight. I think they have good people running their Latin American policy in state and NSC. I do think there's a historic danger of inattention and neglect that the administration has to guard against. I think the president personally needs to pay serious attention to Latin America. He would be very popular there. It's a region, as you know, where half the people are under 20 years of age, and I think he could be very successful, but I think his legitimate interest in domestic affairs has pressed him too far into neglecting foreign policy. And when foreign policy is neglected in general, Latin America is probably neglected even more. And I think that's a mistake, because I think there are real problems out there. And when the United States fails to pay attention, that's when problems develop into crises. And then we're faced with very difficult choices. And then we're put in positions where we don't want to be put in or forced to intervene. And I don't think we should repeat that kind of tragic history.
All right. Two final questions about specific areas. In Mexico, the country is going through some tremendous struggle right now. What should the U.S. posture be as Mexico goes through this turmoil?
Mexico is undergoing two simultaneous and related revolutions: an economic revolution, which has now been institutionalized with NAFTA, of opening up their markets to free trade and foreign investment, and participating as an active, competitive member of a global economy. But that's also dislocating. It will have real effects on the 25% of the Mexican population that live on the agriculture sector, which is going to contract anyway and will contract even more as American farm products come in and compete. And simultaneously, after the Zapatista rebellion, Mexico is facing a fundamental reordering and challenge to its one-party authoritarian political system, and it has to democratize. And I think it's crucial that the next presidential election, which is in August of this year, is perceived to be and is in fact clean and legitimate and accepted as so. And I think the United States has to be careful on how it tries to influence the process, but it has to make its support for democratization clear. The government has agreed to international observers. I think the United States should strongly support UN and OAS observers early in the process to give it legitimacy, to give all sides confidence, and to ensure not only an honest count, but also that all parties and all sides accept it, because we've seen the specter of violence in Mexico this year, and I don't think we want to risk the dangers of an election that would not be seen as legitimate. I think that could be quite destabilizing in Mexico.
This interview with Bernard Aronson was conducted prior to the assassination of the then leading candidate for Mexico's presidency, Luis Donaldo Colosio. Aronson, however, repeated just last month in the New York Times his belief that the upcoming Mexican election must be considered legitimate and clean if further violence and economic turmoil are to be avoided. Finally, I asked Aronson if he can foresee any change in the U.S. relationship with Cuba.
Well, I think we need to rethink to some extent our policy toward Cuba. Our overriding interest should be a peaceful transition to democracy, and I would stress peaceful. Cuba is going to change. The system there has collapsed, and if were it not for the police control that Castro exercises and his own strength, and the fact that so many Cubans who might oppose the regime have left, I think Cuba would have already begun a process of change. That change is coming, but we should try to influence the process to make sure that it happens peacefully. A traumatic, violent change in Cuba could be extremely destructive, not only to the Cuban people, but also to our own interest in stability. How to do that is more difficult than proclaiming the goal, but I think we need to try to bring all sides together, the supporters of the embargo, the opponents of the embargo, and try to agree on a set of criteria that we would lay before the Cuban government and offer them a series of steps that if they move decisively towards democracy and take steps to improve human rights and a new constitution and free elections, the United States would take a series of steps to respond, and I think we ought to spell those out. I think we ought to bring Latin America into that process and ask them to be the brokers and guarantors of such an agreement. But I think we can't afford simply to sit back and wait till something happens in Cuba, because what happens in Cuba could be very traumatic.
That is Bernard Aronson, former Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9418, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9418. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, you can write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, to order cassettes or transcripts, please use our toll-free number, 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.